A black teenager stands before a black judge in a Washington, D.C. courtroom. The lecture is familiar, wasting opportunities that civil rights heroes died for. 6 months in detention for gun and marijuana possession. The judge, prosecutor, bailiff, even the court reporter, all black. The police chief, the mayor, black too. How did a majority black city end up locking away so many of its own children? This question drives one of the most unsettling revelations in recent American history. After the 1965 Voting Rights Act, African Americans finally gained real political power in cities like D.C., yet the policies they helped shape, born from genuine concern, limited options, and unforeseeable consequences, would contribute to creating the world's largest prison system. This isn't a simple story of oppression from above. It's far more complicated and far more human. In 1975, Washington, D.C., where black citizens comprised 70% of the population, 50 black ministers convinced Council Chair Sterling Tucker to kill marijuana decriminalization. Having watched heroin devastate their neighborhoods, the gateway drug theory terrified them. The unintended consequence: while 1975 marijuana arrests rarely led to convictions, decades later, possession arrests for blacks in D.C. would be 8 times higher than for whites, bringing crushing consequences: job denials, housing rejections, voting restrictions. Between 1960 and 1969, D.C.'s murder rate tripled. Gun violence became the leading cause of death for males under 40. Fear permeated daily life, fortified homes, martial arts classes, women afraid to venture out after dark. Former civil rights activist John Wilson proposed banning handguns and shotguns. Black crime victims rallied behind him. Richard Ware, whose son was murdered during a robbery, captured the bitter irony. As black men have more frequently called each other brother, there has been an increase in black killing black. Congressman Walter Fauntroy testified he was tired of handgun funerals. He had officiated at dozens. Wilson criticized judges for excessive leniency and proposed mandatory minimums of 10 to 12 months, no ifs, ands, or buts. Not everyone agreed. The black tradition of arms had deep roots. After the Civil War, newly freed black Americans faced terrorism with little state protection. As Reconstruction collapsed, white supremacists used violence while disarming blacks. Alabama's law explicitly forbade any freedman, mulatto, or free person of color from owning firearms. During the 1919 Washington, D.C. race riots, black veterans organized armed resistance that NAACP leader James Weldon Johnson praised for having saved Washington. The tradition continued through civil rights leaders from Ida B. Wells to Malcolm X. Ironically, gun control gained momentum in the late 1960s, precisely when Black Panthers began publicly arming themselves. Black nationalists, including Stokely Carmichael, argued that gun control was a white racist means of taking away from black people an instrument of self-defense. Despite this history, the black political establishment embraced gun restrictions by the mid-1970s. Two factors drove the change. First, the immediate threat had shifted from white-on-black violence to black-on-black crime. Second, political power had fundamentally changed. Guns had developed special meaning in black communities as protection when government ignored black death. But now, black lawmakers occupied positions of authority, promising police protection to communities long denied it. The question became, would integration of power structures translate into transformed policing practices? Britell Jefferson's 1978 appointment as D.C.'s first black police chief was historic. He mentored over 20 future black leaders, with Isaac Fullwood calling him the all-time affirmative action person who broke it wide open. Yet Jefferson's progressive stance on race didn't extend to policing black communities. When asked about being wrongfully detained as a child with dice shooting boys, he defended the white officer. "If you're with a crowd, you're just as guilty." He strongly backed Maddict Mandinarams for drug and gun offenses, aligning with most black officers who cited lenient sentencing as their top concern. In 1996, public defender James Foreman Jr. represented Tasha Willis, arrested for selling $10 worth of heroin. Friends expected probation or months in jail. The reality shocked them. first-time offenders faced up to 30 years. Someone with Willis's prior conviction, up to 60. The prosecutor rejected treatment, saying programs don't work after two chances. This infuriated Foreman. Addiction specialists know relapse precedes sustained sobriety. Yet we treated drug program failures as disqualifying while never questioning prison's failure. These draconian penalties stemmed from decisions made 15 years earlier when communities like Shaw and U Street, still recovering from 1968's post-King riots, faced open and notorious drug markets with droves of drug dealers sometimes numbering 50 to 100 at single intersections. The crack epidemic devastated Black communities already weakened by economic decline and Reagan-era cuts. Crack created rapid addiction and unprecedented violence as armed gangs battled for territory. Jesse Jackson declared it worse than the Klan. The Los Angeles Sentinel called it the most serious threat we have faced since the end of slavery. By 1988, D.C.'s homicide rate had tripled, earning it the title America's Murder Capital. Traditional revolvers gave way to Uzis. In 1989, 9 out of 10 homicide victims were Black, despite the city being 30% white. D.C.'s aggressive response, Operation Clean Sweep, deployed jump-out squads, teams in unmarked vehicles who swarmed drug corners. The Rapid Deployment Unit's officers rewrote the Constitution every day. Mayor Barry, who once supported marijuana decriminalization, now advocated seizing cars for possessing one marijuana joint. Clean Sweep's first 18 months produced 46,000 arrests, one for every 14 D.C. residents. Yet murders rose from 372 in 1988 to 489 in 1991. Assistant Police Chief Isaac Fullwood resigned in 1992, admitting failure. "I'm tired of seeing Black children locked up every 5 minutes, and it's not having a significant impact." 2 months later, his brother Teddy became the city's 401st murder victim that year. 16-year-old Dante Highsmith was charged with armed robbery after threatening a man at a bus stop with a knife and taking $12. His public defender discovered a traumatic history, removed from his crack-addicted mother at age 8, raised by his ailing grandmother, struggling in school despite showing talent in woodworking. When seeking alternative programs for Dante, the defender encountered the same barrier repeatedly: "We don't accept people charged with violent offenses." This illustrates the fundamental problem with criminal justice reform focused exclusively on nonviolent drug offenders. Even if America released every prisoner held on drug charges, we'd still have the world's largest prison population. Though defense lawyers rarely approach victims, the defender visited Mr. Thomas, the robbery victim, hoping to convince him to support an alternative to incarceration. At sentencing, Mr. Thomas told the judge that while he wasn't sure he could forgive Dante, he was willing to try. Because of this grace, the judge granted probation. Years later, the defender encountered Dante at a construction site in downtown D.C. A man with a hard hat and steady employment who had completed a carpentry program, earned his GED, and now had a son of his own. Incremental changes might seem small against our vast prison system, but they matter immensely to those involved. Mass incarceration was built through countless individual decisions. Perhaps it must be dismantled the same way. One person, one case, one act of mercy at a time. The path forward isn't about assigning blame for impossible choices made under unbearable pressure. It's about recognizing that safety and justice aren't opposing forces. They're inseparable. Real safety comes not from cages, but from communities offering genuine opportunities, treating addiction as illness rather than crime, and preventing violence rather than punishing it. That future requires what Mr. Thomas offered Dante, the difficult work of extending grace to those we've been taught are beyond redemption.